the sound of your city. Right here, right now, every day. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Condon. How are you doing, Phil?
Nice. Good afternoon, Phil.
We're going to be talking to Dr. Keith Ellis, a University of Toronto scholar, and he's an author, translator, a poet in his own right, won many awards. And he is, by the way, a member of the Writers' Union, an honorary member of the Writers' Union of Cuba, which is why we've particularly wanted to talk to him today, because we have just, in August 13, was the 90th birthday of Fidel Castro. And as has done in recent years, Fidel has written a few notes about his thoughts about matters going on. So we want to get Keith Ellis's appreciation of this great figure who remains with us, and what a lovely miracle it is that we have Fidel. I believe Keith Ellis is with us now. Are you there, Keith?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
So good to be talking to you, Keith. I mean, you have traveled to Cuba over many years. You know many of the writers, the scholars of Cuba. You
followed
things probably from the beginning when you first heard about this man in the mountains.
I've been with Cuba for a long time now, yes.
And I should tell people, by the way, one of your most recent books was a collection, a bilingual edition of the poetry of Nicolas Guillén, who's called, I guess, comfortably by everyone, the national poet.
Yes, well, the most recent one is one that came out about 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
Which is a collection, an anthology of Guillén's prose and poetry together.
Uh-huh.
For the first time, an anthology of that sort has appeared.
I hope people would. He's a very important writer, and his life, of course, overlaps that of, and is involved somewhat with that of Fidel Castro. But let's talk, first of all, Fidel was born in 1926, August 13.
Yes, and that's why he's 90 years old.
90 years old. Mm-hmm. And I don't know of any precedent in history of such a remarkable figure. Say, you know, we think of people like Bolivar or Napoleon and such in history.
Yes,
who lived on,
uh-huh,
and not you know, on a farm somewhere or being carried around on people's shoulders to be looked at. But he's been involved his life.
Very much so.
So tell us, what are your thoughts about this? And his he's written Reflections, which I found in Counterpunch magazine.
And in fact, this most recent article or reflection that he's written in celebration of the 90th birthday, mm-hmm, is something that he says he wants to use this experience to bring his the militants of the party in Cuba up, mm-hmm, to date and things, so that he's always thinking about doing things.
Yeah. He has been so consistent. He tells people now, looking at his life, and by the way, he hasn't really encouraged people to focus on him as a personality, but he does has his own reflections on his life. But I saw somewhere a piece of his autobiography where he was talking, and he said, told the story of going to the campus after Batista had taken power, and there were armed policemen, basically civilians with pistols, who were supporting Batista, who told him, "No, Fidel, you know, you better get off the campus. No one's going to be allowed to have any meetings." And he said he decided he would, and he also mentions he had a pistol himself.
It's
amazing he's 90 years old, because he was looking death in the face.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell us about those student movements. He said he found them somewhat disappointing. He didn't think they were ready. In this little short memoir, he said they were not organized. Could you talk about?
Yes, because in this latest article, he mentions that in 1953, he organized, or the students organized, the first March of the Torches. José Martí, he was always thinking about José Martí in those days, and always throughout his life. And he said that José Martí had written in one of the articles he wrote in about 1883, that each person should be a torch bearing light, should be bearing enlightenment for other people. And so they organized in that time in 1953, the first of those marches that has become an annual thing now, the March of the Torches. And when he mentioned that, he said that at that time, the political parties were really disorganized. They weren't in any shape to carry out the fight against neocolonialism, as he called it at that time.
Hmm.
He said that that was the big issue of the time. And there was, of course, the Batista in 1952 had carried out the coup against the constitutional government of Cuba. And that was something that had to be countered. But that in general, Cuba had to counter the idea of neocolonialism. And the political parties were not set up in such a way that they could carry out an effective fight against neocolonialism. And that is what moved the young people, led by him at the time, to do something about changing radically what was happening in Cuba. Mm-hmm. Because the Batista regime had to be put down, but that the Batista regime was just one of the symptoms of the neocolonialism that was reigning in Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Now, his powers of as a public orator who could explain issues to people, I've never seen anything equivalent to it. Yeah. When I think the speech, history will absolve me.
Yes,
I wish people would study that. I mean, he is so literate and so passionate.
Yes.
Could you speak about that speech and what it did to people?
Yes. Well, you notice that he mentioned in this article that we're talking about the gift that his father had of talking to people. That when his father went to another town, not outside of Biran where he was born, he really enjoyed talking to people. And he also said that his father was a good organizer. I think that his father was a model in that sense, up to a certain degree. And he wanted to explain. He had that gift of explaining things to people. And so when he explained everything. He explained from the beginning to his comrades in the struggle that had to be carried out. And that the struggle had to be a full, complete one against, as I said before, the neocolonial situation of Cuba. And that when, for example, he was organizing the military aspect of it, he said that this military aspect had to be something new and different, that he was not Napoleon, he was not... It was not going to be a fight in which people are going to be used as just victims of an opposition where there'd be a high total taken of the soldiers who were fighting, but that it was really a fight to preserve life and to create a new situation in which people would feel as if they were a part of the fighting force. And so that was the ideology that formed the shape of the FAR, the army that was being founded at this time. And so he did that, explaining at every step to people what the new movement was about, and explaining, opening their eyes to the reality that was about them, but that they didn't all understand. Mm-hmm. And it was his joy and his delight to explain things to people.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, his broadcast, I mean, you're reminding me of it, people who familiar with it and lived with it will recall that various journalists made their way into the mountains to see Fidel, and one of them being Herb Matthews, I recall. And they couldn't deny that they were fascinated by him and attracted by him, because he did to them what he was doing to the Cuban people.
That's right.
He could sit down and intellectually engage them.
Yeah.
And it was a match. They found out this man was well prepared. And his broadcasts were important, right? People would listen because at all the time he was telling them in detail about their lives and what was going to happen.
That's right. And he was always a man of broad culture. That was the key thing, that he had many points of reference. When people suffer from a very narrow cultural background and preparation, they tend to see things in a distorted way through a very narrow lens. Fidel Castro never suffered from that. And in all the aspects of the reorganization of Cuban society, he had this breadth of knowledge and of view that helped him a lot to communicate, first of all, with the people and to carry out a policy that could be explained very well in the terms that the people would understand very well. He knew Cuba very well, Cuban culture. He knew Cuban history. He knew Cuban literature. He knew the defects and the deficiencies that were abroad in Cuba. And he knew how to have the people understand that these things needed to be addressed and to be corrected. And so, and that breadth of vision, for example, you remember that when he came down from the mountain, he saw right away that things like little aspects of Cuban culture, like the ballet, like he went almost immediately to Alicia Alonso, the great Cuban ballerina at the time, and had her asked her to organize the national ballet for Cuba, and she did. And then he remained interested in the development of the ballet. And later on, he could, for example, talk about his impression of seeing a young ballerina like Bengsay Valdez dance the Sleeping Beauty, and how moved he was by her performance. And so he remained alert to things, and he remained interested and made the people, added to the interest that the people had in these things in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
The person who reminds me of him in world politics at the moment is Putin.
Mm-hmm.
Putin can, as Fidel can, speak for 5 hours or 6 hours.
Yes.
And he can include everything, and could include culture later on. Very few people in the leadership of the developed countries nowadays are able to do that kind of thing.
Yeah. They all have elaborate staffs who are continually passing them notes.
That's right.
Or whispering.
And on small, little aspects of things. Not on the broad picture, and not being inclusive of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're good company. And it's not surprising that I'm celebrating this birthday. One of the people who should have written to him was Vladimir Putin, who wrote a very fine and moving little note to Fidel in celebration of this 90th birthday.
And by the way, to underline the significance of that kind of rapport, he says in his notes, on his birthday, that Russia and China are two very developed societies with immense potential and scientific strength.
That's right.
And that he says they cannot be intimidated.
That's right.
And he's trying to warn the U.S.
Yeah.
He's been on this theme for years, thinks that it can intimidate or frighten people.
Yeah.
And we're at a point where, you know, it's quite dangerous. But he underlined that. And then he talked about the nuclear weapon. Did you have some thoughts about that?
He
didn't like Obama's speech in Hiroshima.
In Hiroshima, yes. He said that his speech was very inadequate, that Obama didn't find the proper words to address the crime of Hiroshima and or of Nagasaki. And then, he said that, well, there were two main things in that article. One was his interest in early childhood education. He said that it's very important that children start to learn very early in life. He remembered his own experience. Do you remember that it was suggested that he go to Santiago to school to accompany his sister there, and that it was for him a very difficult time because the schooling wasn't very good, and there was great cultural deprivation that he experienced in the boarding circumstances in which he found himself in Santiago. And I suppose that's one of the things that makes him so interested in education from a very early age for children, and in also in the matter of cultural exposure and cultural participation of children in Cuban society.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of the article is the part that deals with, as you were mentioning, with peace and the danger of nuclear war. Because the one experience in which nuclear weapons were used on civilians, the lessons haven't really been learned from that experience. That the United States should be much more repentant about what it did in Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
And that also what is happening, of course, he sees this as a part of, it's a continuation of his interest in the environment and the protection of the planet, Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that in 1992 when he went to that summit of world leaders when he was asked, because they knew his reputation of someone who spoke for long periods of time, they begged him to make his speech short in Brazil at that summit. and they said, please try to keep it to 7 minutes. And he made a speech for 3.5 minutes. It was a record, a sensational performance for Fidel. And not only was it the shortest speech that was given at that summit, but it was the most remembered and most applauded speech. Even Bush, George W. H. Bush, who was president of the United States at the time, applauded Fidel's speech there. So, very careful about the environment and, of course, warning the world, warning the United States especially, because it's being quite reckless again in its attitude to, as you were saying, China and to Russia, both nuclear powers, treating them sometimes Barack Obama speaks to Putin and of Putin as if he were speaking to the president of some backward third world country.
Mm-hmm.
And he's warning them here again that it's very dangerous and that he should be very careful, and the United States should be very careful, because we're now talking about the possibility of the killing of millions of people and the destruction of the entire planet mm-hmm. in a nuclear confrontation. And so that is very much on his mind. It has been the topic of many of his articles. And so that, again, now, on his 90th birthday, he's bringing that topic back to the center.
Mm-hmm. And he's lived through it because he had the hair-raising experience of a confrontation with John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, and in the middle was Fidel.
That's right.
And the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, said, victory will be ashes in our mouths, but we will prevail.
That's right.
A psychopath. I mean, what does he mean, ashes in his mouth? I mean,
yeah.
Matt, very close call. And Fidel was, again, brilliant during that whole episode. I want to ask you, make sure I ask this. People of literature, and you are, of course, a writer and author, editor and poet, and have done this wonderful work on the work of Nicolas Guillen. Writers have been fascinated with Fidel, certainly those of South America. Can you talk about how some of them, maybe Guillen, reacted to Fidel and made what they made of the experience of the Cuban Revolution?
Yes, well, Guillen has several poems dedicated to Fidel. There are several encounters between the two that are really very, very pleasant, very harmonious. And it was fitting that one of the tributes to Fidel on the 90th birthday is one rendered by the Nicolas Guillen Foundation, which is now run by Nicolas Guillen's grandson. And this tribute is a book to Fidel, which has been titled Buenos Dias, Fidel, Good Morning, Fidel. And there are essays by several Cuban writers of today in that dedication. And Nicolas Guillen, of course, is mentioned in almost all of his this poetry. So Fidel and Nicolas have been very close, and not just in Cuba, but of course, I should tell you about other tributes. There is an organization known as the Network of Intellectuals, Artists, and Social Movements in mm-hmm. Defense of Humanity. Mm-hmm. And that network has produced many tributes. Sometimes they're just little letters to Fidel. And in those letters have been signed by many, many writers, some of them Canadian writers, mm-hmm. Canadian scholars. There has also been a book, I haven't seen it yet, it's just been sent to Cuba and put out by this organization too, in which 90 writers in different parts of the world are writing tributes, little essays, to Fidel, about Fidel, in this book.
This is published already. This is out.
Yes,
and
it's
available.
Out. It's mm-hmm. out. I have one of the items in the book, but mm-hmm. I haven't seen it yet.
Aha, it's got something by Keith Ellis. Good.
Yeah. But it's from writers all over the world. Mm-hmm. 90 writers writing tributes.
You know, when he would make a visit anywhere in South America, it was like the population would just turn out.
Well, yes.
It was any leader who invited him had to understand that the leader was the guest and
yeah.
Fidel was the the citizen.
Right. And in any occasion, there could be things like, when he went to the funeral of Michael Manley in Jamaica, the church became a meeting place of tribute to Fidel, of people just crowding into the church and wanting to say hello, Fidel. And in Jamaica, they'd say, "Stay strong, Fidel."
Well, now, so, by the way, Keith, you must have seen him many times. I saw him a couple of times. He was so genuine. I mean, this guy, if you got close to him and said a word to him, if he saw you, he would reach out and touch you. He's very tactile.
Oh, yeah, well.
He liked to talk, and he looked at you like, yes, it's like you maybe your old friends or something.
Yeah, and sometimes he'd lean on you.
And he's a big guy.
Yes, and he would, and he'd be absorbed in what he was saying, of course, and making sure that what he's saying is the full answer to what you asked him. He's very, very cordial, very courteous, a really good, genuine person with love for people.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the driving force of Fidel.
Mm-hmm.
He loved people. Of course, his own people, first of all, the Cuban people, but people elsewhere. And that is why when he thought of things like, say, public health, he'd think of public health that would serve everybody within Cuba, that would be open to everybody. It had to be designed in such a way. Whatever it was, public health, education, even sort of coaching people in how to think, to how to analyze things. In the way in which they set up an electoral system, for example, making sure that it was so straightforward, so simple, so direct, that children could supervise the voting. He was always just so passionate about the inclusion of people, of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so when these systems were set up in Cuba, like public health and so on, he did it bearing in mind that people elsewhere needed the kinds of services that were needed in Cuba too.
Yes.
And when they set up for Cuba, he had in mind places outside of Cuba, different countries. That's why, for example, when he set up the medical system, the personnel, medical personnel, when there was training for medical personnel, not only did he have schools, medical schools, for serving people coming in from abroad to study medicine, and many scholarships given to these people.
Including Americans.
Including Americans.
Black Americans went to school there.
There's black and some white Americans. Yeah. Americans from areas that were that needed doctors. Mm-hmm. And these Americans, the Americans who made the pledge that they would go back to those areas that they came from and serve the people in those areas. So that he's always considering. And then, of course, apart from that, there are these brigades that were set up to serve people in terms of disasters, natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, and so on. The Cubans were always the first to respond when countries were faced with these things. Not only was a system set up within Cuba to make sure that the toll was minimized of victims, defending the population from things like hurricanes and so on. But also, there'd be these brigades set up that would help people abroad. You remember when Hurricane Katrina affected the southern United States, that Cuba had one of these brigades set up to help the people there.
Yes.
And had them all ready to go, and proposed it to Bush at the time.
Oh.
But Bush said no, people are dying on the sidewalks in Louisiana.
And that's something.
and they wouldn't accept the Cuban help. Well, you know, that's the kind of cruelty that is almost incomprehensible.
The difference between a reactionary and a revolutionary.
Yeah, almost incomprehensible to Fidel that people should treat the people like that.
Yeah. And lastly, Keith Ellis, we can safely say Fidel is 90 years old, and he has stayed the revolutionary course.
Well, indeed. I mean,
nobody's blown him off his course.
No. As I said earlier, that he's making use of this experience, his birthday experience, to keep the militants of the Communist Party in Cuba aware of things and what can be done, what should still be done. People have to be kept on their toes, because of course we know that Cuba is in a situation where that cruelty that was shown by Bush has been shown steadily by the United States toward Cuba, and so they're used to fighting against this kind of cruelty, and they're used to preparing themselves against these things. And that is why I said before about the power of analysis that the people have mastered. And that is why the things have remained calm in Cuba amidst all this sort of hostility from abroad. They've fought against the embargo. They've fought against the embargo. Loss of their friends from the Eastern Europe and so on. They've survived, and they've learned. They're learning, and they're teaching other people how to survive.
Well, Keith Ellis, scholar and poet, we're very appreciative. We hope we can talk about it again in next year. And we hope Fidel continues on the way he is.
Yeah, we wish him many
more years.
Happy birthdays.
Thank you, Keith Ellis.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Taylor Report, CIET 89.5 FM. We're going to play you a bit of the Cuban national anthem just to show you what Fidel has done. I'm fighting with the anthem. Anthem 1. This is the Taylor Report. CIUT 89.5. You can get us on SoundCloud, the Taylor Report. And I wish I knew what I was saying, but I know it can be done. We're on SoundCloud. And we're also facebook.com/ the Taylor Report. So please check us out. Our programs are available. This is, for example, the tribute to Fidel by Keith Ellis, who is so knowledgeable about the life and career and thoughts of Fidel. People will really benefit. Pass it on to your friends.